This is Thursday, June 30th, final day of June, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Coming up, Turkey says that three suicide bombers who carried out the attack on the Istanbul airport were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. The United States adds eight more countries to its list of nations doing the least to end human trafficking.
It's stunning. It's outrageous that even today, the magnitude of the human trafficking challenge cannot be overstated.
And another surprise in the tale of a Brexit vote. All of that and more on today's International Edition. We start today's program with word from authorities in Turkey who say the three suicide bombers who carried out the deadly attack on the Istanbul airport were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Turkish officials are continuing to believe that the attack was launched by Islamic State fighters, but they didn't name the bombers, who authorities say fired assault weapons at travelers and workers on Tuesday at the international airport Ataturk before blowing themselves up. We welcome to International Edition Soner Çaptay, the Bayer Family Fellow and Director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute in Washington, D.C. He's written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations, Turkish domestic politics, and Turkish nationalism. Soner, thanks so much for being with us. Does it surprise you that these attackers have been identified as being from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan?
Perhaps not, because we know that a large number of foreign fighters from Russia and the former Soviet states, including Central Asia, have unfortunately were able to go through Turkey into Syria in previous years and set up shop there, including joining Al-Qaeda affiliate Nusra Front, as well as the so-called Islamic State. I think that the Islamic State picked those fighters with Central Asian and Turkic origins primarily because of their linguistic skills. If these people spoke Kyrgyz and Uzbek, these are languages related to Turkish, so they were probably able to, you know, move around more easily in Turkey than would have been the case for speakers of Arabic from North Africa or the Middle East, or people who came from Europe and did not speak any of the languages. And I think that definitely gave them the advantage of being able to move around the society without being identified necessarily because of their linguistic skills. And you also have the issue that, of course, Russia's northern Caucasus region has been a hotbed of radical activity. And when the Syrian war started, the Russians actually encouraged most of their radicals to flow out to Syria, because this to them was their way of exporting their jihadist problem into Syria. And now that jihadist problem, unfortunately, is being exported from Syria into Turkey.
So it sounds like that you do agree with the identification of those attackers as being ISIS attackers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what leads you to that?
Well, the modus operandi of the operation looks like this is ISIS. How so? Multiple attacks, simultaneous attacks, attackers who mow down people with machine guns in order to cause the most number of casualties and then detonating themselves. That's also ISIS MO, as we saw recently in Brussels and Paris and other places. So this is clearly linked to ISIS. And I think, though, the group will never assume responsibility. Let's be clear on this. Unlike in the West, and for example, in the United States and in France, where when ISIS carries out an attack, it goes ahead and assumes responsibility, because this to it is propaganda to recruit unstable, violent-prone people from those countries. In Muslim-majority countries, ISIS never assumes responsibility for attacks because it likes to create an air of fog and suspicion. What do I mean by that? It carries out an attack, kills lots of people, one more, lots of people, does not assume responsibility. What happens next is in these societies, people start blaming each other. Government blames the opposition, opposition blames the government, suspicion rises, and soon you have retribution-style attacks. This is exactly what happened in Iraq. The mothership from which ISIS was spawned, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, carried out a large number of suicide bomb attacks in Iraq between 2005 and 2007, killing hundreds in each attack, never claimed responsibility for any of them. But after each attack, people started blaming each other in Iraq. The case was Sunnis versus Shiites. and that soon turned into retribution-style attacks and killings. And at the end, Iraq descended into a horrible civil war. I think that's the impact ISIS wants to create in Turkey by not assuming responsibility, so that it's hoping that the government will blame the opposition, in Turkey will be the Kurds and leftists, and they will blame the government. And, of course, then you're going to have this air of fog and suspicion, which ISIS loves. That's going to be the strategy moving forward. Should we see further ISIS attacks, they will not assume responsibility for such attacks. And I think in the face of that, Turks should be careful to avoid the Iraq trajectory. Instead, they should stay united against the face of ISIS threat, as well as identifying this group as a main and existential threat to their country right now.
So what does this do to the Turkish government's line against the Islamic State? Do they harden their stance? What do you think is going to happen here?
It does harden it because so far, let's say, for Turkey, if the threat, number one, was the Assad regime, because Turkey has been singularly focused on ousting the Assad regime in the Syrian civil war, ISIS was maybe threat number two, maybe three. It was sort of subservient to the other issues, and it was never seen as an existential threat, if a deadly one, perhaps, at most. Now that's changed. ISIS has targeted the heart of Turkey, Istanbul, and the main artery of that heart, which is the country's most busy airport. It is a sign of Turkey being open for business. It's a sign of Turkey being safe for investors and visitors. And targeting that, ISIS is targeting Turkey's economic well-being. So it's really escalating its conflict against Turkey. So my expectation is that it is now seen by the government as threat number one, more existential than anything else the Turks are perceiving, including the Assad regime. So we're definitely entering a new phase in the ISIS versus Turkey struggle.
Well, you have termed this in the past, that relationship, as almost a cold war, Muslim against Muslim. However, does this make it into a hotter war?
I think that this is going to be a serious war moving forward. Now it's a hot war because ISIS has asked for it. For me, the question was never if, but when ISIS would target Turkey. And the reason is simple. If ISIS is the anomaly in Islam, Turkey is the normal in Islam. Turkey is, first of all, a secular country with democratic traditions and gender equality. It's a member of NATO, is in accession talks with the European Union, a friend of the United States, and has just made up with Israel. Everything Turkey has is antithetical to what ISIS wants to create. So it was not a question of if, but when the group would attack Turkey, and that attack came, unfortunately, in Istanbul. And at this stage, I think it's fair to say that ISIS is engaged in full hot conflict against Turkey, and Turkey will retaliate.
Sadr Çaptay is the Bayer Family Fellow and Director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. Thanks so much for being with us here on The Voice of America. Interesting interview with him, and we welcome now to International Edition Andrew Palshesky, and he said a lot of interesting things. This, obviously, in his mind anyway, is not the end but only the beginning of problems between ISIL or ISIS, Islamic State, and Turkey, and things just continue to expand. What's happening on social media?
Well, on social media, we're kind of seeing these dual conversations going on. On the one hand, there's a lot of talk about these arrests that have been made, about the nationalities of the bombers and what that means, how this fight against ISIS is going forward. And then on the other conversation, you're seeing a lot of mourning for the victims. We're finding out more information about who they were. We're finding out about who, some of the names of the people that have been killed. And some people questioning if enough attention's being paid. They said after Brussels and Paris, there were all these hashtags, pray for Paris, pray for Brussels, people changing their profile pictures on social media to put kind of flag overlays for the country. Not seeing as much of that for this attack, and they're questioning whether it's equal kind of attention being paid on social media to this attack as it was previous.
And maybe because some are Muslim and some are not, that's a possibility.
Well, right? There are a lot of questions like that being raised on social media.
What
for
else?
Sure. Well, we thought Brexit was bad in the UK, and then the UK soccer team, the England soccer team, lost
to Iceland,
and now it's political upheaval in the UK. Things are going from bad to worse. Boris Johnson, who was widely expected to run for the Conservative Party leadership, has said he's not going to do that. There's upheaval as far as who is going to step into that role, leaked emails about plans to run or not run for the... It's playing out on social media, and I've seen a lot of social media posts where people are saying, you know, this is about the 17th crisis that's happened just today in UK politics. So,
Of course, the big crisis is the loss to Iceland.
Well, that's of course, in the forefront of everybody in England. Means, yes. They're the forefront of the English soccer fans' minds. But this political upheaval is playing out on social media, like we said, and the names are popping up. Boris Johnson was trending after he said he wasn't going to run. Theresa May, who is now maybe the front runner for the Conservative post, she's the Home Secretary in the UK. Her name has popped up. So we're seeing just it all playing out stranger than fiction.
But your major story, of course, is this is a big day, right?
It is a huge day. June 30th, happy social media day. It is social media day today. So we're seeing a lot of just people saying happy social media day, but people trying to show how social media has been used for goods, for raising awareness for certain campaigns and issues. Safety for social media. Of course, kids that are on the internet need to be safe when they're using that. And, of course, all the memes that people are posting saying, thank God for social media, because now we have all these fun memes that we can share. And also people just saying thanks. Thanks for following us. So thank you all out there for listening and for following us on social media at VOA_IE.
And there's a cake out of the newsroom. Actually, the cake is for Susan Yaki, our friend.
Another big trending topic in the newsroom today.
The host of this program who is retiring, and we wish her nothing but well. We all love Susan. And Andrew, thank you so much. And people want to get in touch with you. You know, Andrew is a pal.
I am a pal, at a pal on Twitter.
Andrew Palczewski, Social Media. This is International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, the United States added 8 more countries today to its blacklist of nations. It said it's doing the least to end the $150 billion worldwide human trafficking industry. Turkey says the 3 suicide bombers who carried out the deadly attack on the Istanbul airport were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Taliban suicide car bombers struck a police convoy in the Afghan capital of Kabul. It killed nearly 40. And conservative favorite and Brexit proponent Boris Johnson says he will not be running for Prime Minister of Great Britain. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's thought that the first telescopes emerged sometime in the 17th century. But is it possible that ancient stargazers could have studied the heavens with their own observation tools long before the modern telescope? In a project presented to the National Astronomy Meeting being held this week in England, scientists are proposing to learn whether or not long, narrow passageways or prehistoric tombs were used as a way to enhance views of the night sky some 6,000 years ago. The scientists want to find out if the human eye might be able to see stars of any given brightness or color without the help of any telescopic device in locations such as the Seven Stone Antas in central Portugal. Those proposing this investigation say that ancient astronomers were able to better observe certain stars from deep within one of these passageways. Spotting a particular star may have provided a way to mark the seasons. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington on the Voice of America. The United States added 8 more countries Thursday to its blacklist of nations it said are doing the least to end the $150 billion worldwide human trafficking industry. The U.S. State Department put the former Soviet states of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan on the list of its 27 worst offenders, along with the fledgling democracy of Myanmar, Haiti, Djibouti, Papua New Guinea, Sudan, and Suriname. Kuwait and Thailand were moved off the lowest Tier 3 ranking of the annual listing, promoted to a Tier 2 watch list, indicating they were making efforts to combat the trade in humans, but still under scrutiny. The State Department said that the governments in Libya, Somalia, and Yemen were too chaotic to be able to judge their efforts against human trafficking. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the magnitude of the human trafficking challenge cannot be overstated, as the State Department released its annual Trafficking in Persons report for 2016. Kerry called the devastating trend of human trafficking modern-day slavery, which claims more than 20 million victims.
And all 20 million are people, just like everybody here. They have names. They have or had families in many cases. And they are enforced to endure a hell, a living hell in modern times that no human being should ever have to experience. In some places, particularly where violent extremists are able to find a contemporary safe haven, and I might add a temporary safe haven, the atrocities are both rampant and overt.
Kerry highlighted the need for focus on countries where violent extremists are holding men and women as slaves, calling on the international community to hold countries accountable to a higher and better standard of behavior. This is VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Let's check on the Brexit story. Conservative favorite and Brexit proponent Boris Johnson says he will not be running for Prime Minister of Britain. Johnson announced he'll not be a candidate for leadership of the Conservative Party, leaving Justice Secretary Michael Gove and Home Secretary Theresa May, who backed the Remain campaign, as frontrunners to lead the country. In announcing his decision, Johnson said that after consulting with colleagues, he was not the person to lead the nation.
My role will be to give every possible support to the next Conservative administration to make sure that we properly fulfil the mandate of the people that was delivered at the referendum, and to champion the agenda I believe in.
Johnson, the former mayor of London, strongly campaigned for the Leave campaign and was expected by many to run to lead the country as it severs ties with a 28-nation bloc. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced his resignation after Britain voted last week to leave the European Union. The next Prime Minister will be tasked with negotiating Britain's relations with the European Union. As well as the rest of the world, the country is expected to face some harsh tariffs and economic turmoil as a result of new trade deals with angry European nations. And Britain may also feel rising resentment from Scotland, which voted to remain in the bloc and may hold another referendum to secede from the United Kingdom. This is International Edition from VOA. A new film starring Oscar nominees Viggo Mortensen and Frank Langella looks at the struggle between values and what's best for a family. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Captain Fantastic has Mortensen playing a father who has to struggle with his idea of what it means to be a parent.
What we created here may be unique in all of human existence.
All the way to top.
We created a paradise.
Ben is a free spirit, a counterculture rebel who lives with his wife and six children in the woods in Washington State. He is rearing the kids with a rigorous intellectual and physical regimen, but he wants to turn them into bright, respectful adults. However, he has also kept them away from life outside their bohemian existence. That all changes when Ben's wife, Leslie, who has to be hospitalized for depression, commits suicide. Ben and the children want to attend her funeral, but her father, Jack, played by Frank Langella, refuses to allow it. Ben then faces a confrontation with Jack, and the kids experience a world they have never known. At the film's premiere in Los Angeles, Viggo Mortensen said that the movie explores not only what it means to be a parent, but also what defines a good parent.
I think it's always been hard. I don't think it's harder now than ever. I think it's always a question of what kind of parent you want to be. Do you want to be the kind of parent that says no because I said so, or do you want to be the kind of parent that says maybe not, and let me explain why? And if you have a counter argument, I'm willing to listen. That way is harder. It takes more time and energy, but it's worth it.
Captain Fantastic debuted at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year to great acclaim. It went on to win a directing prize of the Un Certain Regard section at Cannes for Matt Ross. Ross says that this film did have unique challenges, but he was pleased with the end product.
Every movie is difficult, and it's amazing that any movie is ever made. The particular logistical challenges in this movie were that there's six kids in every scene, there's two musical numbers, two stunts, both of which involve children. We're a road movie, so we're in different locations every single day.
Annalise Basso plays Ben's daughter, Vesper. She says the cast had to go through an outdoor boot camp to prepare for the film.
That was my first time really camping because we built our own shelter. And that I would say, is the craziest experience for me, just because it was totally nothing. All we had were sleeping bags. And we scavenged berries and plants from the woods. And for dinner that night, we had that. And also, someone brought salmon.
Captain Fantastic also stars Samantha Isler as Ben's daughter, Keeler, and English actor George McKay as his son, Bodovan. Captain Fantastic is rated R for language and brief nudity. It is set for release in the United States July 8th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that is going to wrap up our program for this day. My name is Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. Our director is Patrice Martin. Our engineer, Andreas Ivanov. And we'd like you to enjoy your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwean communities in the Yanga district will be able to construct facilities to dramatically improve their health and sanitation, thanks to assistance from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and its Community Water Supply, Sanitation, Hygiene, and Natural Resources Management, also known as CWASH program. In early June, at the Ruronquo District Development Fund Rest Camp, Robert Shawatama, the Provincial Water and Sanitation Subcommittee Chairperson for Manicaland, officially handed over to the people of Nyanga District $40,000 in materials to construct or rehabilitate 83 boreholes, 45 pumps to extract water, 105 drinking troughs for animals, and 102 latrines. Chairperson Chawatama also presided over the graduation of 18 community latrine and water pan builders and 16 village pump mechanics, who had been trained by Development Aid from People to People, or DAP Zimbabwe, with funding from USAID. With guidance from the District Development Fund, these builders and mechanics will assist the communities in constructing and repairing their water infrastructure and ensure long-term sustainability. In total, USAID's CWASH activities will provide safe and clean water to 2,400 households and 6 schools in the district. The communities of Nyanga North have long grappled with access to safe and clean water due to frequent breakdowns of boreholes. Some families travel for 10 kilometers to access safe water, while others sleep queuing for water at the boreholes. Many boreholes in the district are being chained and locked as communities try to safeguard limited water resources. Others have introduced strict water rationing, with households only allowed to collect 2 20-liter buckets per day, regardless of the household size. USAID is proud to support Nyanga District to improve access to safe, potable water, said USAID Zimbabwe Acting Mission Director Bruce Abrams. With this newly acquired technical expertise and building materials, these communities are now able to protect themselves against waterborne diseases.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.